We were young then. We were young, and I would have thought that we are living together. You come preach for me, I come preach for you, and your anniversary and my anniversary. We were living together, not in the sense of living in the same house, but living in the same era, in the same generation, that our relationships have been lifelong. I could see dozens and dozens of people in here that I remember from way, 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 way back when, and we all thought we were living together. You have to live a while to figure out that it is not so much that we are living together. More aptly put, we are dying together. Halfway through your life, there are messages and emails and texts that come from your body and your bones and your joints and your tissues and your cells and your corpuscles that says you're not going up, you're going down. We are dying, and it changes how you treat one another. Imagine if we were all on the Titanic and if we were all going down together, we wouldn't be so petty. We wouldn't fight over foolish things. We wouldn't be so territorial. We wouldn't be so political. We wouldn't be so analytical. We wouldn't be so self-aggrandizing if we all recognized that we are a generation fading into the shadows. It causes a different level of appreciation. Every moment we interact with each other ought to be a little bit more special. Every time we connect with each other, we will not allow the voice of the enemy to inflict some poison into our interaction, because we would appreciate that we may not ever have this opportunity. So I better, if I love you, I better say something right now. And if I care about you, I better say something right now. And if you're valuable, if you help me in some kind of way, I ought to say something. I don't have to compete with you. I'm glad you got what you got. Do what you can do as long as you can do it, because there may come a time that you will not be able to do it. Jesus lets us know a doctrine, a theology about dying, that even though the pure emblem of the Christian faith suggests that there will be suffering, we tend to obliterate the ideology that there's any suffering in faith. And occasionally we come up with the idea that if we have enough faith, we will go through nothing and we will get everything we want, and that our God is not God, it's that he's Santa Claus, and that he has come to give you your wish list for Christmas. And we have this theology that omits suffering, but a big clue that suffering is in the strategy and the structure and the infrastructure and the composite of God himself is exemplified by the very emblem of our faith being a cross. The cross is a big clue. And Jesus flamboyantly and openly, when he called his disciples, said, if any man must be my disciple, let him pick up his cross and follow me. Can you imagine making an altar call at a time that Jesus lived in? The cross was not an emblem of worship, but a place of suffering and degradation. It was like an execution chamber. It had no spiritual significance. Can you imagine making an altar call and telling them, if anybody will join this church, let him be prepared for a gas chamber? At that time, we had not had the hymnist pin the old rugged cross. At that time, the cross had no endearment about it. At that time, it was common to see men die and sometimes decompose in shame on crosses. Crosses had nothing to do with religion. It had something to do with Rome's torture chamber for people who rose against the powers that be. Still, Jesus warns us that it is bigger than Rome and it is bigger than Caesar. That God has left space in everyone's life for a cross. Jesus delivers his final homily from a cross, perhaps his most powerful session on his exodus as he prepares to depart, is delivered to us with splinters gorging into the blood gaping holes of his back where he had been beaten with a cat of nine tails. He is denied even the luxury of liniment or band-aids. He presses his open wounds into the rugged cross and there delivers his homily. Jesus teaches us that preaching is painful, that serving is painful, that it is not the glamorous thing to which many people who aspire to it think that it is, but in reality, your gospel must be proven in your life and in your suffering and in your agony, and you start out preaching it, but before you get old, you have to live through everything you preached about. You find out that it's more than a hoop and a holler when your back is pressed against the wall and there is no comfort and your mouth is parched and you have to beg for hyssop. You begin to recognize that preaching means thirst. It means suffering in secret places. It means dealing with agony that we don't even talk about. And I was wrong when I said we were living together. We are, in fact, dying together. When I look at this text, Paul is in this text, but Paul is in a grave situation. He's in a terrible situation, and there are so many characters that contribute to the context for which I will extrapolate some ideas, and I'm trying to figure out. Let me back up and say, aside from what I do in the pulpit, I own a television production company that does film and deals with scripts, and people bring you stories that must be converted to scripts. And if the story is good enough, and this one is amazing, you have to turn it into a script. And the first thing you have to decide when you're turning a story into the script is which one of the characters is going to do the talking. I was watching Soul Food the other day. I told my wife, isn't it funny that they chose the little boy to be the narrator to tell the story of the old Soul Food movie that was on years ago. You know, COVID has got you in the house so long you're watching the old stuff. I love Lucy. I'm out of everything. I'm watching stuff that I forgot even existed. And that was, we were watching Soul Food. And the question has to be, who tells the story? And my first thought when I look at the text is it Luke, the physician who has journeyed with Paul, who has given us the Gospel of St. Luke and the book of Acts as one piece divided only later? Is it Luke that is the narrator, because he is the contributor that writes the story in so much detail that even contemporary meteorologists have to confirm the authenticity, that this journey would be tough at the time that is specified because they're traveling in the winter. And they're traveling in the winter at a time that most people would not be willing to travel. And I thought maybe it ought to be Luke, because Luke is one of the contributors to the four Gospels, who is not an apostle, but a contributor nonetheless. He writes with a level of intelligence and intellect that far exceeds those of the other Gospels, because he is so educated that he articulates this to the point that modern day meteorologists can read this story and tell the climate of the times around the ship. And it does matter what's going on around you when you sail. I have sailed when the coast was clear and the breeze was high. I have sailed through good times and marvelous times, but to sail through the time that we are sailing through right now is perhaps the most tempestuous time in the history of our lives. To operate ministry right now in the middle of COVID, in the middle of 200,000 plus people dead, 5 million people inflicted in our country in the time of governmental chaos, in the time of racial divide, such as we thought we would never see again, in the time of such turmoil that there is a certain stress that is devolved, not only from the circumstances, but just the uncertainty. Uncertainty is its own affliction. You don't know what to plan. You don't know what you can have. You don't know when to set something on the date. You don't know how long before things are going to get better. And anytime our souls are uncertain, there is a certain agony that comes from the invisible influence of uncertainty.